You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
Welcome to a show we're calling Jonathan and Larry Take On. This is a part of a somewhat monthly series we're producing for Radio Berkman. I'm Daniel Dennis Jones, one of the producers of the show. Each month we choose a theme, and usually it's one word or phrase that has some relationship to internet, politics, technology, and law, and let our two co-hosts and a wonderful audience, you, get back to the basics and figure out what it really means. Last month, our hosts took on competition. This month's show takes on an issue so divisive, so intense, and so confusing that it may seem audacious to try to tackle it in one single hour, but we'll do it anyway. That issue is net neutrality. So without further ado, I will introduce our two hosts, Larry Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain.
Thank you, Dan, and good afternoon, Larry.
Hi.
So, when we talked about competition, we started from a kind of historical frame, and maybe that makes sense to do that again here, with net neutrality being a pretty Byzantine and confusing, and yet we are told so important topic. What would you mark, Larry, as the kind of milestone that opens up a discussion on this issue?
Well, for accidental reasons, the FCC decided early in the history of the internet that the wires that your telephone came across, or the telephone used, were a facility that had to be open for other people to connect to and to use however they want, as long as they didn't harm the network. This was a attachments principle and a non-discrimination principle that evolved over many, many years of litigation and battles over wonderful technologies like the hushaphone and the like. But by the time the internet came along, it was pretty well established that you should be allowed to use your telephone however you want to use it. And people started using devices called modems to trick the telephone into being a data-carrying network. And initially, the telephone companies were like, hey, wait a minute, we didn't intend our telephone system to be used in this way. We intended our telephone system to be used for people to talk. But the government's like, I'm sorry, as long as they're not breaking the network, they get to use the telephone system however they want. You're trying to stop me.
Pausing right there, you could imagine even at that point, the use case for modem is very different for the use case for voice. You might sit on a modem and play, you know, Adventure all day long in text at 300 baud. But you could see leaving your modem on 24/7 with a flat rate connection taking up an entire circuit. So I'm just curious, even then, could you see a reason why a phone company would say modems ought to be treated differently than voice conversation, where who actually stays on the phone 24/7?
Exactly. Well, that's exactly what they were claiming. And, and they had good economic reasons for complaining. It made sense. Even more obviously, you know, you could use modems to evade long distance requirements, right? So if I wanted to connect to a BBS, for example, that was all the way across the other end of the country. Remember, these were the days when it cost money to make a long-distance telephone call. Instead of dialing directly to that BBS, I could connect to a local line that would connect to another local line that would connect to another local line.
So-called FidoNet.
Right, FidoNet-like structure, so that we get to all the way to the other end without anybody ever paying for long-distance phone calls. So they had lots of reason to be upset about this, but the government was pretty clear. You had to let the phones be used however you wanted. And then anybody was allowed to create this competition in this context, because around 1996, when the government enacted Communications Act of 1996, they embraced an idea that for the telephone wires, we would have to have open access, which meant that for telephone wires, ISPs had the right to connect to the telephone wires and offer internet service through the telephone wires in competition even with the local telephone company.
And here, are you talking about high-speed internet or modems?
Right,
still?
Now we're still talking about we were talking about dial-up. But then the principle got extended to anything that came across the telephone wires. So in addition to dial-up service, of course, there is DSL service on the telephone wires. And initially, the FCC took the position that DSL service, too, was, because it was on telephone wires, open to this kind of competition in the last mile ISPs. So you could have lots of different ISPs in the last mile competing to provide DSL service.
And just to be clear, we're kind of following along. What you were describing early with just the idea that if I want to use my phone line to place a call with my modem instead of with my voice.
I don't know why we have to have dogs in
As soon as I mentioned FidoNet, a dog ran into the room and appears to be vying for attention. With
I don't
a
think
discussion
Glenn Beck has
neutrality.
To have dogs when he's doing his shows.
Yes. Leslie Gonsitrain, take on canines. The early phase you were talking about, where people could just as easily use a modem as use their jawbone to talk to people and pay the same rate, that's still basically a non-discrimination principle because they were still basically getting their phone service from a baby bell.
Exactly.
And that baby bell in America might be regulated six ways from Sunday as to what prices they can charge and all that sort of thing. And then if they find that they're losing money, they appeal to some government authority and say, we'd like a price increase kind of thing.
Yeah. So it's a constant argument about what fair pricing was and all that sort of stuff. But the basic principle was very heavy regulation to make sure people could use their phones however they want. And then the second stage of this was that competitors could use the phone wires to offer internet service, broadband as well as narrowband.
And in the vernacular there, you might call that open access as distinguished from net neutrality. So you could still have had mere net neutrality as DSL came online and phone companies figured out how to use their copper wires installed however many years ago for telephone to carry high-speed data, not just modem junk. And you could see just saying, yeah, you're going to get it from Bell Atlantic still, or whatever it is, and this will be your price, and it's negotiated. But instead, there was this period where you might be thinking you're getting it from Earthlink, and Earthlink is basically a brand and a different headquarters that is basically reselling services that would otherwise be coming from Bell Atlantic.
Exactly. So this 1996 Telecommunications Act had, with respect to telephone wires, the principle of open access. FCC could change that, but that was the presumption. With respect to cable wires, governed by a completely different title of the Communications Act, Title VI, there was no requirement of open access. So in the period right after the statute was enacted, I feel like an old man now, I remember these big battles right here at the Berkman Center about which paradigm should govern both cable and telephone
wires.
Because
it seemed clear that they should be governed by the same paradigm. It was weird that one was one and one was the other.
It was weird that they were different. There were all sorts of arguments about why they should be different. They didn't seem very persuasive. But the initial fight, and many of us here, and I was part of this fight with Mark Lemley at Stanford, were pushing very hard to get the FCC to extend the idea of open access into the cable side so that you would have open access on cable as well as dial-up, or as well as DSL. And the idea was, let's have lots of competition at the last mile of service so that you have ISPs interested in giving you faster service at cheaper price. Initially, there was some chance that the government was actually going to do this. And in fact, at different stages, depending on what AT&T owned, AT&T was in favor of open access, AOL was in favor of open access. But as those companies merged into cable companies, then they began to be against open access.
Quite naturally, anybody that didn't own the pipe wanted a shot at reselling themselves and sell it directly. And just to be clear again, on cable side of things, that was another network kind of serendipitously repurposed to broadband. It was originally, and still for many is, cable television, but it also happened to start carrying broadband internet over it.
Right. And it was, in many ways, it seemed to people it was going to be a better service for doing it because the capacity to do it across cable was going to be higher than the capacity over twisted copper.
Because cable came later. It was designed to carry more signal, more TV, rather than just a conversation kind of thing.
Right. So along comes a man named George Bush, and he gets a lot of support from five justices on the Supreme Court, and he becomes president of the United States.
And that was gratuitous.
I know. Well, I couldn't resist. And he picks an FCC commissioner, chairman, and the FCC commission begins to march down a path which is very different from the fight that was happening before. The fight before was whether open access should extend to cable. Now the question was whether no open access rule should be extended to DSL or to the telephone.
Which is the
wires.
Rule and which is the exception, basically.
Yeah.
And then should the exception be abolished? Now, let me just momentarily break the narrative flow to ask another question. You had said before in the open access regime on telephone wires for DSL that there was then competition among what to a consumer looked like different internet services, but they were really coming from the same underground gas tank, basically. It's just the gas pump had a different label on it. How is it then that if I get my DSL from Earthlink, who in turn is getting it from Bell Atlantic, that Earthlink could actually offer me faster service? I guess they could offer me cheaper service or different bundles or something, but is the quality of the service I would get from one of these resellers better than from a seller or another reseller?
Well, it depends what they add into the infrastructure, right? So maybe they add different caching service or maybe they add different facilities that make it better that you're getting that better kind of infrastructure to support that service.
And I guess at the time, open access itself could mean different things. It might mean something as modest as it's all the same service, it's just branding, and who, when you call an 800 number for customer service, who you reach, to something more ambitious, which has to do with segmenting the frequencies on the wire, and Earthlink gets one set of frequencies and somebody else gets another, and then one could implement something faster in their section.
Yeah, the answer was, the fact was nobody really knew how it was going to play out.
Okay.
But the theory was, let's try competition. And competition was tried in the DSL space. And what we had was literally thousands of ISPs. And competition was not tried in the cable space. And after the Bush administration came into office, the rule was, let's basically remove the competition that's happening in the DSL space by adopting a rule that basically eliminates the need for open access, even in DSL. Now, to be clear, you know, there was a lot of problems with open access in DSL. People often contrast Japan with the United States. Japan adopted the same kind of open access rule, but when they did so, the telephone infrastructure was basically a government monopoly. They were government bureaucrats. The rule came down from on top that you had to open up your service to any competitor. The bureaucrats just did it. That's what, you know, they just obeyed the rule. And there was lots of good...
Just like a bunch of fire hydrants. Okay, now anybody can connect to a fire hydrant and set up a sprinkler or set up a fire hose.
And they had no incentive, these bureaucrats, to discriminate against anybody. They were just facilitating the service. When we implemented open access, we had broken up our monopoly. And now we had competitive baby bells. And these competitive baby bells were fighting for their life to figure out how they were going to make money. So when the government comes in and says, you have to allow your competitor onto your wire, it just turned out that the wire didn't work as well when that competitor was on the wire as when that baby bell was on the wire. And the government tried to come in and say, oh, we're going to fix this problem. And it turned out there were so many complexities to getting this to work very well that there are a lot of people, for good reason, said maybe open access isn't such a great idea.
And you could see the consumer thinking, if I'm going to get a hamburger, I might as well get it from McDonald's rather than Schmickdonald's, which gets it wholesale from McDonald's. It cools off a little bit, and then I eat it.
Yeah, you shouldn't eat hamburgers.
All right, then. Diet advice as well.
Okay, so after this happens, we launch into this period, which we could call the kind of period of deregulation. Like the theory of American broadband policy was deregulation. We're not going to regulate the DSL providers or the cable providers to allow competition. We're going to let them provide their services as they want. And the theory behind this theory was that would give them enormous incentives to invest all sorts of money in building out broadband. It would lower the cost and increase the quality of broadband. And by today, we'd have a wonderful utopia of broadband.
And there the idea would be, if I'm a DSL provider, because I'm the telephone company that operates those copper wires and now has DSL on it, I can recoup all the profit from upgrading those wires, from making it work better. And my big competitor, like for me, the unibrow baby, is going to be the cable company and vice versa. So then we'll just get into a, you know, Hertz versus Avis situation.
Right. So I remember when this all started, it was a conference actually here, and somebody was advancing this theory. And I said to the person sitting next to me, you know, it's a good theory. I don't believe it. It's a good theory. But let's see what happens now that we've embraced this theory.
I think I was the person sitting next to you. I wasn't paying attention, though.
Yeah. But you were so kind about all of my theories back then.
You're listening to a very special one-hour episode of Radio Berkman. This week, Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig take on net neutrality. In the previous segment, Jonathan and Larry covered where telecommunications policy comes from the telephone wire to today. But how did we get to the idea of net neutrality?
So here we are 10 years later. And the Berkman Center was actually right in the middle of a very interesting historical moment about this theory, because when the new administration came in and they decided they were going to figure out what broadband policy should look like, the new administration asked the Berkman Center to conduct a study of broadband policies around the world. And Yochai Benkler, who had been looking at this problem forever, ran the study. And over the course of the summer, people around here worked night and day to pull together this study. And the conclusion of that study was countries that had followed our open access policy, the policy we had announced in 1996 and lived with for at least 4 years.
For DSL.
Mm-hmm. People had followed that, you know, generally in their governments, had much better internet service than we did today.
Better as in faster and cheaper?
Yes. So, you know, people often think, well, that's, you know, Korea and Japan, and somehow physics works different in those countries. That's why it's so much better.
But people
there.
Live more densely.
Yeah,
so,
maybe, whatever. Yeah. You want to give your excuse. But think about countries like France, right? In France, for $30 a month, the equivalent of $30 a month, you can get 20 megabit service, internet service, plus telephone service, plus international calling service, plus television, plus free Wi-Fi in a bunch of hotspots around France.
And coupons for hamburgers.
No, you don't get hamburger coupons there. And that because they had adopted policies that drove that kind of competition and produced this sort of extraordinary low-cost, high-quality service everywhere around the world except in the United States.
And here, just to be clear then, in France, how many wires are there running into the average Parisian's home carrying broadband?
Basically one.
But there's a wholesale price that I gather then must be kind of fixed by the government to be low, because otherwise that monopolist could jack it up way high. And then with that low price, I guess enough not to have the underlying company go belly up or require massive subsidy, then you have all the competition at the retail layer.
Right. The actual details of how these different countries did it, you know, was slightly different. But the point is, if you followed the policy as we originally announced it, you are doing well. And if you followed our policy as we adopted it circa 2000, you were doing really poorly. And in fact, we fell dramatically, depending upon which scale you look among industrial nations in our broadband quality. So we have more expensive, poorer quality internet service in the United States today than exists in most of the competitors that we live in, that we are competing with. Now, all of that is kind of, in some sense, background to where the network neutrality debate began. So after it was clear that we weren't going to adopt open access anymore, after it was clear that the FCC wasn't going to push open access, they were backing away from open access, and that was not going to be anywhere in the policy, people started talking about, was there another regulatory response that kind of accepted the idea that only one company was going to own the telephone wire or one company was going to own the cable wire, but would still preserve the essence of what the internet had been before, namely this neutral network where lots of people could compete to provide content and applications? And that's where network neutrality gets born. Tim Wu was really the first person really framing it and talking about it in that context. I remember in 2002, I testified at the Senate Commerce Hearing Committee about network neutrality, but that was a conversation that came out of a conversation with Tim Wu about this idea. But the basic idea was, were there regulations that could substitute for the kind of infrastructure we thought competition would give us and preserve competition in the network so that we would have lots of opportunity for new content and new applications to grow on this network?
And here, it wouldn't be so much price competition, but you're thinking about other ways in which they might try to make money off their network that get foreclosed in a net neutrality regime?
Right. So the basic idea behind network neutrality was going to be non-discrimination. So you tried to create rules that blocked providers from discriminating against either content or applications in the providing of their service.
And I guess a classic example of that that's been bandied about is so-called voice over internet. That if I'm getting my DSL service from the local telephone company, and then I use the internet connection at a flat rate to do all the telephone calling I want, I'm no longer paying long distance. That could be seen as competitive. You could see an ISP on the DSL line wanting to just say, no, 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 you can do everything but that. For that, you must use this traditional telephone.
Yeah, and in fact, the first time the FCC stepped in here, it was because a DSL company was said to be blocking voice over IP for exactly that kind of reason.
Uh-huh.
So there are lots of contexts in which you can imagine these platform providers having an interest to block certain applications and certain content. Because if they block those applications and content, it makes it easier for them to strike a deal to make more money with the dominant provider in some other space.
That's the biggest beat.
You're listening to a very special one-hour episode of Radio Berkman. This week, Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig take on net neutrality. In the previous segment, Jonathan and Larry talked about where net neutrality came from, but we're getting mixed signals from corporate players and internet service providers. Are they eager to jump on the neutrality bandwagon? What about Google and Verizon's VGoogle compromise to adopt net neutrality for wired networks if they can only have free reign of mobile internet access policy?
Now, fast forward to the present day in late 2010, where it does appear to be consensus, including from the DSLs and cable companies of the world, that that form of neutrality is okay? Does it seem as if they're actually willing to concede that they shouldn't be playing fast and loose for purely, you know, economic deal-making reasons with where a customer wants to send or receive bits?
To believe that's true would be to betray extraordinary naivete.
Well, I'm glad no one believes that to be true. Why do you say so?
Well, so what you're referring to is the Google-Verizon, quote, settlement or framework. And the Google-Verizon framework basically says that for the wireline internet, we're going to have these kind of network neutrality principles. But for the wireless internet, we're not. Now, I don't believe that's because Verizon and Google both believe that network neutrality is important and essential for the wired internet. I think it was because there was a compromise made, a deal struck, where Verizon got to say, we're not going to have network neutrality for wireless provision, but we will have network neutrality for wired provision, because in Verizon's view, the future is wireless. So the whole game is, where are we going to be able to extract our rents, as economists would put it, in the wireless space, and let's just give up the fight over the wired space, because that's not going to be a long-run benefit for us.
But that's still pretty cool, right? Why is it naive to say, at this point, if, say, a regulatory body or somebody were to come forward and say, okay, you know, we take entities like Google and Verizon especially at their word, and we will now enshrine into some mandate that they not discriminate on wireline services, that's not a bad thing to have locked in, is it?
No,
and it would be hard for Verizon to turn around and be like, no, that's, it would be dangerous for our network, because here now they've publicly said they could do it.
No, but I believe you said, and if we had a transcript here, we could ask it to be reread. But I believe you said, doesn't this show that everybody agrees about this? And I don't think it shows anything like that. I think it's just a settlement, a deal that's struck because they're betting their cards, they're betting their game on the future of wireless and not caring so much to fight about
it. I guess I'm just looking at an FCC public notice from just over a month ago for their so-called NPRM, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, which had been a rather bumpy path because the Federal Appellate Court had said the FCC, under its chosen jurisdiction, didn't have the ability to do what it was doing. But in any case, the FCC seems to have just dusted itself off, and they say, you know, this has been a very helpful discussion out in the world because now we have narrowed disagreement. Broadband providers should not prevent users from sending and receiving lawful content, at least on fixed or wireline platforms. And some form of anti-discrimination protection is appropriate, at least on fixed or wireline. So that does nicely appear to be kind of locked in.
Yeah,
right?
But the reason why this is a bad, in my view, a bad deal or would be a bad policy is that if we allow the wireless space to embrace non-neutrality, we're going to replicate exactly the problem that we have been fighting over in the wired space for the past 10 years, because you begin to build businesses on the assumption that you can discriminate. And then if people down the road want to come along and say, you know, it turns out discrimination is a bad thing for this platform, let's have non-discrimination, then those businesses are going to be eager to spend the net present value of the value of their discrimination game to fight those regulations. So rather than getting us into the place where we're going to have to fight against vested interests who want to preserve the non-neutral wireless internet, we ought to be setting up the platform of neutrality on the wireless internet to replicate the platform of neutrality that the internet itself originally gave us, because the one thing that surprised everybody was that that neutral platform produced an extraordinary amount of innovation that that in many contexts wouldn't have been produced if it hadn't been neutral.
And for those who say there's reason why, at least under today's wireless, which is an order of magnitude slower than wireline, where a lot of people using it simultaneously can lead to congestion or that kind of thing, that there is reason not to want to just have, hey, if you want to be running BitTorrent, who cares if it slows down everybody else's email?
Yeah, but that would be a confusion if somebody believed that.
Uh-huh. A naive confusion.
It could be. Because network neutrality doesn't block the ability to deal with congestion. Network neutrality, at least as being discussed right now, is blocking the mode by which you deal with congestion, right? So if you deal with congestion by saying, here are the companies whose content we're going to slow down, or if you deal with congestion by saying, here are the applications we don't want running across our network, that would violate network neutrality. But if network neutrality principles said, we're going to deal with congestion in the following content or application neutral way, that's perfectly consistent with network neutrality. And that's exactly how the internet used to deal with congestion, right? You know, things would slow down. And as they slowed down, it would deal with it in just here's the first packet, here's the second packet, like way.
Got it. And in fact, if you look at the FCC's notice that I was quoting from before, as they're trying to continue their rulemaking, one of the other principles they say around which there's consensus is broadband providers must be able to reasonably manage their networks, including through appropriate and tailored mechanisms that reduce the effects of congestion or address traffic that is unwanted or harmful. So you're saying they're basically, even the most heartfelt net neutrality advocate concedes that you may have to take some action should there be congestion. And there's some actions that, so long as they fit certain criteria, that are just fine for a company to take.
Right, right.
Okay. All right. So wireless is one question left open. And it seems from a careful parsing, at least, of the Google-Verizon framework agreement that they're kind of just punting on it. They don't appear to be agreeing that, oh, wireless doesn't get non-discrimination, just we'll save that for another day.
Right. And you know, I think this is a classic example. We now see three or four examples of Google doing exactly this. You know, Google thinks it's doing God's work, to borrow a line from Wall Street. And because it's
a fictional movie, that is.
No, from the real Wall Street.
Okay.
And because it's doing God's work, it's trying to advance all the great principles of the network. And it can't imagine that it would do any harm in doing that. So it was faced with a context where the policymakers, who we had elected to actually implement network neutrality, were not doing that. And they wanted to strike a deal to at least get us halfway towards the good answer here. So they feel like they're doing good by striking this deal with Verizon and getting us halfway to the good answer there. I think they did the same thing with the Google Book Search settlement. They've done the same thing in other contexts as well. But I think it's naive and a mistake, because what the settlement does is create the presumption that this is a decent answer for policymakers to embrace. And the problem with that presumption is that it's wrong in this case. We shouldn't be embracing the compromise with wireless.
Well, I suppose in this case, too, Google could find itself to be a wireless provider. So it could find itself as an internet service provider as easily as it is a content provider. And so conveniently, it might be that they're not embracing, rushing to embrace net neutrality
for
the
evil.
Networks.
That would be evil. And they're not evil.
You're listening to a very special one-hour episode of Radio Berkman. This week, Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig take on net neutrality. Jonathan and Larry covered some of the motivations and posturing of the corporate sector around net neutrality. In this segment, they take some questions from a very gracious audience.
Hi, I'm Andrew Kuklowitz. I'm the technical director at the Public Radio Exchange and do a lot of work with the internet and iPhone development as well, well, mobile development as well. I guess it just occurred to me, I hear a lot about the net neutrality debate. I haven't heard a lot brought up about some of the ways that what people are trying to achieve by subverting net neutrality has already been achieved with different things such as content delivery networks and other kind of technology solutions to arrive at the same goal of different service from different providers. Is there an answer to the critics of net neutrality that really these are already solved problems, you just aren't talking about the solutions that are already working?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I can see that you might see these, quote, solutions or problems as the same. But I do think there's an important difference. So, for example, you know, Akamai is a very important caching service that's out there, and companies spend a lot of money to support Akamai caches that provide faster service because you've got this.
And we should just give a quick thumbnail sketch of how an Akamai does what it does. The way the internet works by default, so-called best efforts network, otherwise known as send it and pray, or every packet an adventure. And there's no way to assure from one end to the other that the packet will get there in any particular period of time because there's so many intermediaries that pass it along from one to another, and the contracting would be very complicated. And so far away parties may have a hard time guaranteeing that their all-important stream of, you know, America's least wanted gets to the people that want to watch it at the right rate. So Akamai says to people that have content, how about you pay us some money and we can see to it that your content gets to various audiences faster and maybe even at a basically guaranteed rate. And Akamai then delivers on that promise by going to the likes of a Comcast or a DSL provider, and they say, how would you like to boost the speeds by which your customers get to stuff on the internet? All you need to do is interoperate with us or host a little server in the corner of your server room, and we're just going to put some content there. And magically, when people ask for content that's far away, because we're also in cahoots, that sounds bad, because we're also providing services to the faraway content provider, we can just seamlessly redirect the user to that nearby server that's very close to them for the stuff they asked for that really originated far away. Now, the only catch is that to take advantage of what Akamai has to offer, if you're a content provider, you have to write them a check. Now, isn't that a problem, given that one thing I've heard a lot of net neutrality advocates raise as a potential issue, I'm not sure it's actually happened, is that a given internet service provider would not only charge their customers to provide internet service, but would charge the faraway content provider like Google for the privilege of reaching their customers. If that is bad, why isn't Akamai also something that's not so good?
So that's nicely framed. That's exactly the distinction I want you to think about. Why are the two different? And if they are different, it's because there's more competition or the potential for more competition in the Akamai space than there is potential for competition in the pipe space, whether that's a wireless pipe or a tube provided across cable networks. And so the thing to worry about is where that power to discriminate is being leveraged by the throttle on the flow, rather than where there might be differences in pricing or opportunities based on stuff that is in the competitive marketplace. So, you know, you look at in the real space, in the real world, you know, let's say you've got two law firms and one law firm sets up and spends a bajillion dollars building a really beautiful building, really attractive artwork and attracts a certain kind of, and the other law firm, you know, just sets up in like a building like the Berkman Center, you know, it's kind of run down, poorly painted, you know. You might look at that and say, oh, it's terribly unfair because, you know, one set of clients has all this great stuff and the other set of clients doesn't. But the reason to be less worried about that is that all of the inputs to that are inputs that come from a competitive market. If you blow up the market and say you're against markets, then you might be troubled with that. I'm not. I think markets are pretty good things in most contexts. The place to worry about markets, though, is when it's not really a market. It's not really a competitive space. space where this distinction is being drawn. It's a space with lots of monopoly power.
And but so that's why you could actually see, though, content delivery networks as being amenable to natural monopoly because the number of agreements you have to make and co-hostings.
I'm not saying there's a reason to believe that they could never create a problem. Uh-huh. I'm saying here's the reason to believe that they might not be creating the same kind of problem that's being created on the wired network. So I'm open to hearing complaints about them, but the complaints can't ever be. It's never enough to say, "Geez, this company can do really well because it spends lots of money doing X." That's too imprecise. You've got to wonder whether the thing they're spending money on is the sort of thing that anybody can spend money on, or the thing they're spending money on, they get to spend money on because they have a special relationship with this core throttle through which people get access to the network. And the principle of the network neutrality is not that people can't, or at least the principle that I believe in network neutrality is not that you can't, you know, can't have customers who pay more to get faster service. It's just whatever that discrimination is, it's open to anybody to be to opt into it.
And how about the second question that says there are huge costs that you must recognize as somebody who has just gone on record approving of markets to intervention in those markets and anti-discrimination regimes and complaints if you think the regime has been violated and all this kind of stuff, where the claim is, you know, water finds its level. And maybe you'd see some of these big barge companies that offer a form of what you just called throttle trying to be a little bit clever in not letting voice over internet protocol happen. But then somebody just VPNs or comes up with some other, basically think of it as an icon that you double click on. When you double click on this icon, whatever limit was present in the network gets bypassed because you can basically make anything look like all you're doing is going to YouTube. Like everything can just look like a web page. And if that's the case, why do we need a whole regulatory regime, at least in the absence of evidence that there's terrible things going on?
Well, I you know, confess that I'm increasingly worried that the way we think about the regulatory regime is too technical. You know, we think that what network neutrality is a bunch of rules about how Comcast is going to run their network, as opposed to thinking about the objective of network neutrality, which is to create the incentives for the bit providers to provide a commodity service. You know, we want commodity bits out there. We want people to be in the business of providing the commodity bit at the fastest speed they can at the lowest price. And network neutrality rules that block discrimination might invite all sorts of gaming around the edges that evade the ultimate objective of the rule, which is to create the incentives for commodity providers. And that maybe the way we should think about the regulation is instead to think about what kind of rules could we create to build incentives into the providers to behave like commodity providers rather than behave like people are going to strike special deals.
Now, this raises another issue that's come up in the paperwork here, which has to do with so-called specialized services. It's referenced in the FCC rulemaking. It's referenced in the Google-Verizon framework. I gather that a classic example of a specialized service would be legacy cable TV that comes over your cable wire or legacy phone service that comes over your DSL. And that actually is an example of something uniquely offered by the wire provider that's pretty simple to use. There's plenty of people that might not know how to get Skype up and running with a headset that, thanks to a Radio Shack telephone hooked up to a jack that's just the telephone jack, that's all it really does, modems notwithstanding, that's actually like a benefit to the consumer, just as being able to go up to that weird set-top box, turn it on, ignore everything on it except the number that is the channel you're on, and channel surf. Those are examples of services that if you couldn't see the commodity frequency provider being able to offer those things, it might actually be tough for consumers.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why actually the specialized service section of this is imagining offering providers the opportunity to build a non-neutral network in some sense next
to cable broadband,
right,
and that DSL sits next to telephones.
Right. If cable broadband were a neutral network right now, argument about whether it is, that's a perfect example. You've got on, you know, across your cable wire, one channel or maybe two channels devoted to broadband and 120 channels devoted to this non-neutral television service on top.
And I guess if some engineer at Xfinity, the cable provider, just, I don't know, discovered some new law of physics or some other great innovation that could triple the bandwidth on that coaxial cable, the cable company would immediately have to decide, do we want to offer more pay-per-view through cable or do we want to offer faster broadband?
Yeah. Now, the issue that people are arguing about with that, though, is that if you start allowing the internet providers to add this special service to the side, then are they going to have an incentive to, in a sense, cannibalize the internet service in order to support this specialized service on the side? So if you imagine cable television companies now offering one channel that's devoted to this broadband service, then being permitted to create something next to it that would be a specialized service without any net neutrality rules, would they degrade the service they're offering in the ordinary internet space in order to create the incentive for people to opt into the non-neutral
network? I suppose the answer there might be, I guess the market would decide for them. Wherever they thought they could earn more money because it was more valuable to people is what they would do.
Yeah. And if we had a really vibrant competitive market here, you might have a good reason to be less concerned about that. But one of the big complaints that people raise about our regulatory history is that because of the last 10 years of this deregulation system, we now have a world where there's very little competition in broadband provision. So that, you know, you might be in a market with one provider or two providers, a DSL provider and a cable provider. And so the ability for competition to check this bad behavior by the broadband provider has been removed.
It would be interesting to see at some point a cable internet provider say, to hell with this, we're just going to provide cable now. Like, who needs this internet broadband junk? We're going to use every ounce of our cable going into your house to offer you basketball from eight different angles in real time.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what it'll be.
You are listening to a very special one-hour episode of Radio Berkman. This week, Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig take on net neutrality. In the last segment, Jonathan and Larry suggested some ways the net neutrality debate might be replaced by better innovation and service from internet providers. But since the market isn't really demonstrating much of an appetite for risk-taking these days, net neutrality looks like it's still very much on the table. So, David Weinberger asked the $64,000 question. What is the solution? What should the FCC do?
If net neutrality is a policy that's designed to make acceptable a structural situation which is not all that acceptable, that is providing commodity bits in an environment that is seems to be, the incentives seem to be so heavily skewed towards providing bits for which people pay. For particular content or services, how do we get to the right structure of the industry? Or maybe we don't, but if we could, how would we?
And let the record show, David is asking this of Larry, who wrote an article in Newsweek not that long ago, 2008, asking to destroy the FCC.
Yeah, the original title was Blow Up the FCC, by which I don't mean use dynamite, but it was deeply skeptical of entities like the FCC achieving that objective. So the cynical, the depressive answer here is to say we can't. You know, so look at the way the FCC responded again to the Berkman report. It was too difficult to imagine opening up the question of open access again. Too difficult because so many entrenched interests inside and around the FCC believe they shut that debate down 10 years ago, they wouldn't even consider this as an alternative. It didn't even merit a footnote in the report because there's such an extraordinary amount of influence that's driving against that kind of solution. And the criticism I leveled against the FCC in that Blow Up the FCC paper was, we should recognize that in some sense, this is built into the DNA of the FCC. The FCC was created originally not to encourage competition, but to protect the incumbents against extraneous things that were going to make it impossible for them to deliver reliable service. And, you know, the latest versions of the FCC all talk about how they're interested in facilitating competition and you know, not benefiting any incumbent. But if you actually think about the way our political system works, even for this ostensibly independent agency, it turns out that our political system turns that agency into an agency designed to protect the incumbents against new kinds of competition. So I would blow up the FCC and I would replace it with, you can think of it as a IEPA, the Internet Environmental Protection Agency, or the Innovation Environmental Protection Agency. And basically that would have just two jobs. Number one, it would be a critical test for deciding when monopoly-like rights make sense. So spectrum rights that are handed out as monopoly, but it also could answer questions about like patents, or it can answer questions about copyrights. Does it make sense to extend an existing copyright? I think we know the answer to that. But
yeah,
does it
the Supreme Court?
No, they didn't know the answer to that. Oh, but the rest of us knew the answer to that. But in other contexts, you know, there's, I believe, you know, a copyright system is essential to make certain kinds of creativity possible. But we should ask a critical question about how essential, or what's the contour of that essential policy. So that's the first thing it would answer, which is when and what kind of monopolies make sense. But the second thing it would address is just basic infrastructure questions to make sure that innovation in the space can happen. So supporting infrastructure around broadband to make sure that the cost of that infrastructure is low and sufficient competition exists in that infrastructure. And it would keep that kind of minimal intervention to maximize innovation as its charge. But we're far from the ability to do anything
about
that right now.
This raises the natural question: what would make this agency any more immune from the forces you say buffet the FCC than the FCC? Is it going to be like the Fed or something?
Oh,
not
God
that the
forbid.
Fed really works exactly.
Yeah. Well, no. We'd have to be intelligent about the way you structure it to make sure that it has the kind of independence in its internal structure, right? So that the decisions about, you know, which structure of monopoly rights make sense are being driven primarily by social policy, you know, study, like an economist analysis of this, as opposed to political decisions about how it's going to.
It does sound like the Fed.
Let's not bury the idea so quickly.
Are you still on your depressive answer, by the way?
Yes.
Okay.
Was there a non-depressive answer?
I don't do non-depressive. I'm sorry.
Listening to a very special one-hour episode of Radio Berkman. This week, Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig take on net neutrality. Jonathan and Larry suggested destroying the FCC and starting over with a more holistic and competition-nurturing regulatory approach. In this final segment, Terry Fisher asks if simply implementing a policy architecture like net neutrality or open access, which was recommended by the research work of Yochai Benkler, is enough. Jonathan and Larry follow up by asking if we are even fighting the right battle right now. Does the internet as we knew it when the net neutrality debate began even still exist? And does it even matter? Is there still some sort of underlying principle worth fighting for here?
It strikes me that the strongest argument for some variant of network neutrality is that it will help preserve an environment in which there's openness, some measure of equality, some measure of democracy in access to the internet, the ability to deliver material, deliver content, deliver applications, and so forth, even if, at least in the short term, that's inefficient, meaning that even if we could satisfy consumers' current desires for stuff more efficiently by having more concentrated access to it. Now, interesting complications would arise if you extended the efficiency calculus into the very long term. For relying actually on some of Jonathan's work, one could contend that it's only a short-sighted conception of efficiency that makes this point interesting. But bracket that for a moment. The reason why this hypothesis, that this is the real justification, seems to me to matter is that if Yochai succeeded, and or if the United States eventually falls into 100th place behind jurisdictions that adopt a more open regime, and we switched to the 1996 version of must carry rules in principles for all technologies, I'm worried that that would appear to make the network neutrality concerns disappear, because now we would trust a competition among the providers rather than government intervention to achieve the kind of openness we're after. But if my hypothesis is right, it won't. It won't cure the problem. As I say, until and unless we follow Yochai, this is more or less irrelevant. But suppose that we did. So I guess that's the bottom line here. Would adoption of Yochai's recommendations make network neutrality unnecessary, or is there still a need for some agency, be it the FCC or some EPA, to enforce it?
Yeah, great question, because before people were talking about network neutrality, following the kind of internet geeks who invented the internet, we spoke about this as the end-to-end principle. And the end-to-end principle is not the kind of, you know, marketing conception of owning the customer, you know, completely. But it was the idea that the network be architected so that it's as simple as possible in the network, and all the intelligence is pushed to the edge of the network. And that was the principle as the network architects articulated end-to-end. And open access was thought to be a means for creating the conditions under which end-to-end would thrive. And network neutrality is conceived of as a means to create a context within which end-to-end would thrive. But I think there's been lots of great work, in particular Barbara von Schewick, has her book about architectures of innovation, suggested even under an open access regime, you could certainly have incentives for discrimination to develop that would defeat this objective of end-to-end. So you're right, it's not sufficient to have Yochai's world. It's not sufficient even to have the network neutrality world. It needs something more to make sure that these things add together in a way that produces that kind of end-to-end architecture and the incentives that that produced.
So to go back to a really early historical example, I suppose there's some reason why a single first-class U.S. stamp gets a letter from anywhere to anywhere, irrespective of the distance. It's not just because, oh, it's more convenient that way because people then don't have to worry about how far they're sending their letter to know what stamp to apply. I think there's also some sense of equality that has to do with, just because you live far from everybody, you shouldn't have to pay more to send them a letter, to communicate with them. And it's whether or not that's really the basis behind stamps costing the same for first-class mail, I don't know. But it is a reminder that in some ways this is, at the end of the day, about expression. I mean, content is a weird word. Like, Shakespeare is content. But it's about expression. And the idea that you could have routinely expression that is disfavored and maybe even unpopular, so there would not be market demand to reach it in a way that would be enough to convince any given competitor to worry about opening up an avenue to that expression. You could see how the kind of competition envisioned by open access doesn't speak to that at all. I mean, a lot of the arguments are just economic arguments. The bits might as well be, you know, pellets of steel or food or something rather than ideas and information. And that would be a mistake to think of them as the same. So when I look at, say, name your organization, I don't care if it's the NRA or NARAL Pro-Choice or whoever that wants to run a pretty edgy ad during the Super Bowl or just during a State of the Union address, which is being broadcast on five channels, and none of the five networks wants to broadcast that because it's controversial. Now, maybe if you don't like to see that kind of communication come out, you're like, well, good, the system works. But if you worry about systems that become insular and that unpopular ideas get squelched in a way that is bad structurally, even if you disagree with them, you could see how wanting, if not a regulatory regime, a kind of just in practice, the way the state of affairs is, it's really difficult to prevent people from getting to the content that interests them, no matter how obscure or rare it is that that content is desired. You could see why you would not just lean on competition to answer those questions. And I think it also gets to the issue of, hinted at by Larry's invocation of the Japanese example, which is, you know, even more extreme than open access, or less market-oriented than open access would be from one perspective, is just the government provides this, the way they provide the highways. There are very few private highways lying around. It's just like it's a common thing, and we don't inspect your truck to see what's in the back, whether it's worthy of being on the highway. We don't ask whether, like, do you really need to take those iguanas, you know, to Western Massachusetts? Like, really? And one question would be, if the government were to provide really good broadband, fiber or something, and then open it up the way the Japanese bureaucrats are said to have done it, would they be able to avoid the temptation to start doing content discrimination for name your thing the government doesn't like? And my guess is they wouldn't, and that we'd then get into all sorts of constitutional issues reminiscent of when can people be in a public park and when does the government get to issue a license. And in some ways, it's very refreshing right now to just be beyond that. The government just isn't in a position to be doing it. And the worst we have is the kind of thing about controversial ads on the Super Bowl that no market player wants
to
have.
Wait. Now we're going back to the first episode that we had about competition.
You mean the last episode we had?
Or the first.
Yes. We've only had two episodes.
But I want to say the first and the last, because this is the second. Because, you know, one of the things that we shouldn't forget, our love for the open internet notwithstanding, is that an extraordinary amount of the internet now lives on these owned platforms, right? So Facebook, 500 million people are Facebook.
Wait, that's my line.
I know. I'm trying to give you back your line because you were veering off into this weird First Amendment stuff for you, and I didn't understand where you're going with this, right? So here's your line. Let me feed it back to you.
I'm
you
more
live
of
in
a
this...
Third Amendment kind of guy. All about the quartering of soldiers.
In a sense, that's exactly what this is about, right? Because because a 500 million people live their life in the Facebook space. And what is the Facebook space? It's a space where Facebook claims they have the right to control what applications and what content are going to run on that.
So do you think there should be a content non-discrimination principle for Facebook?
Well, I'm saying we have to remember that in the context of worrying about network neutrality or the end-to-end principle, the big bear in the room is, I guess it's elephants that are typically in rooms, right? It's the elephant in the room is the fact that, in fact, our network is migrating into these own platforms, and we have no way yet to talk about what the principles should be on those own platforms. And so when you say, oh, it's so good, we don't have the government to, you know, to figure out all these hard questions, and instead we just have the internet, what in fact we have is company towns rather than government space. And the difference between the company towns rather than the government space
Welcome
is
to Farmville.
Farmville.
Population more than there are people.
Right. But the point is, in those spaces, we have no claim to begin to raise the First Amendment concerns that you were articulating bizarrely 5 minutes ago.
Naively, too.
Yes. Because, of course, those principles don't apply in these private domains of proprietary networks.
Yes. Which, again, makes me wonder, well, what are you saying? That the First Amendment.
Again, you're wondering what I'm saying? All the time you're wondering what I'm saying? That's my problem.
Just trying to pin you down here.
I'm not saying, I'm not getting into the question whether the First Amendment should apply to Farmville.
The future of Farmville and how to stop it.
Yeah. Inside joke. See Jonathan's book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It.
In fact, this entire session was an elaborate ad for my book, which is available online for free, which is why we are academics and not business people.
Yeah, I'm trying to emphasize here is that we need to recognize
that we typically fight the last year's battle.
Yes.
So we're all obsessed and excited about the network neutrality issue, and we might be missing the bigger story here, which is the internet's disappeared, and what we've got left is a bunch of these closed proprietary platforms.
And it shows that there really are layers upon layers, that it can be important maybe to have at the bit level the freedom to send your bit in any direction. But then on a layer above, if Farmville and Facebook become so wildly popular that that's where you want to be sending your bits because that's where everybody else is, that then they can decide not to let your bits find eyeballs because that message gets taken down or something like
that. Yeah, and it's more complicated. I mean, it's, you know, people always listen to this complaint or this depressive story and they say, oh, yeah, this is just AOL, but look what happened to AOL. But it's not just the AOL, right?
Yes.
It becomes, you know, what Facebook and, you know, God love them, I have all sorts of praise for what they've built. But what Facebook has done is create a space where the interaction depends upon you living in the Facebook's platform, right? So, you know, you say, well, if you don't like Facebook, you can just run away and go someplace else.
Because, you know, Friendster is still there.
That's right.
I still get weekly updates on my friend at Friendster. It's like, hi, friend. Let's have a tea party. Yes, and that's where I suppose you could look to somewhat analogous, not exactly to net neutrality, but to data portability and interoperability, so that there might be a way to read Facebook messages from outside the wall and see what.
But even that wouldn't get you what you need, because if, you know, people say that kids, so Dana Boyd would say that kids these days don't use email, they use Facebook messaging, right?
Yes.
So how do you port your Facebook community out of Facebook into, you know, the competitor to Facebook that gives you better privacy controls? You know, yes. The answer is you can't. The ability to lock you in a very happy, you know, beautiful space with lots of cool kids and lots of parties is much more effective in the current version of the internet than it was before.
Sort of ending on a Matrix kind of theme. But last question, and we need to wrap up. I think there was some interest that for us to take on this issue together, it's not like we're really debating here. In fact, I've just been asking a lot of questions and you've been offering a lot of semi-views. But, you know, some would say it's like a debate about political systems between Mao and Stalin. Like,
are you Mao or Mao?
I'll tell you at the secret Politburo meeting to follow. So let me ask you a question, just put to you in your talents as a lawyer, which is to say, give us as best you can what you figure the quote-unquote other side would be here. What are we missing? What humility do you think is needed for all of the statements and kind of history we've covered with pretty good confidence about what we think is the right answer?
Yeah, I think that the strongest argument on the other side was the argument uttered circa 2000. And the argument was, we need to create the incentives for people to build out these very expensive infrastructures. And the way to build those incentives or to create those incentives is to give them exclusive control over the infrastructure they build, because they'll translate that exclusive control into lots of profits, and therefore they'll have...
And I suppose not at least have the specter of they build it out under one set of rules and then retroactively they have to open it up.
Right. So that was a good theory. I mean, it, you know, it was plausible. It made sort of some good sense. But again, you know, if we live in a fact-based policy world where we actually look at what happens and make policy judgments on the basis of it, it's kind of hard to believe that that was true, because we've seen people who adopted the opposite theory did better than we do, and we've not done so well under this theory.
Well, I think with that, we wrap up yet another episode of... It's only our second episode of whatever we call our show. We'll have it down soon. Yeah. It's been a privilege and an honor talking about this stuff with you. With that, we're out of here.
And that about does it for this very special episode of Radio Berkman, Jonathan and Larry Take on Net Neutrality. This episode was produced by Molly Soder and myself, with special help this week from Jake Shapiro, Amar Asher, Seth Young, Lisa Carlovati, Zelena Gray, David Weinberger, and of course our two gracious hosts, Larry Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain. Got any thoughts on this week's episode? What did we get right? What did we get wrong? What topic would you like to see Jonathan and Larry take on next? Leave us a comment on the show notes for this episode at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman, or shoot us a tweet. Our handle is Radio Berkman. This show is released under a Creative Commons license, so if for some reason you wanted to put the quote of Jonathan and Larry saying destroy the FCC into a Public Enemy Chuck D remix, here it is again for your convenience.
And let the record show, David is asking this of Larry, who wrote an article in Newsweek not that long ago, 2008, asking to destroy the FCC.
Yeah, the original title was Blow Up the FCC, by which I don't mean use dynamite.
From the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm Daniel Dennis Jones.